This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you've ever flown in or out of Logan Airport, you've flown over Boston Harbor, and you've probably seen those 12 giant egg-shaped buildings on Deer Island. They form the heart of a years-long, multi-billion-dollar effort to clean up the harbor that today makes the waterway a shining example of what an urban harbor can be. But the next time you fly, look again. And imagine what happened under the water, just off Deer Island, in 1999, when five men ventured down a Deer Island tunnel that was so dark and so deep that they had to rely on specialized breathing equipment to navigate the pitch-black, oxygen-starved hole in a bid to complete the final stage of a crucial and massive engineering mission. And then their equipment fails. But what failed long before those men even entered the tunnel was an entire design, contracting, and engineering system that put the needs of a high-profile federal project before the safety of the working-class men charged with completing it. Neil Swidey tells the story in his marvelous new book, Trapped Under the Sea, One Engineering Marvel, Five Men, and a Disaster 10 Miles into the Darkness. Neil Swidey is also a staff writer at the Boston Globe magazine. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, before we get into the harrowing story of what happened to these five men exactly, why don't you remind us briefly why Deer Island, you know, even exists and why this huge engineering marvel, you know, had to be created to help save Boston Harbor?
Sure. If you think back, it wasn't that long ago that Boston Harbor was disgusting, fetid, foul, national embarrassment. Here was the waterway that was indivisible from our nation's history, and yet had been allowed to turn into this cesspool of human waste. It took a lot of effort and political will and engineering prowess to sort of make the transformation possible that we see today, that the Seaport District, that beautiful harbor that is now the source of all the energy in Boston. But they needed to do it in a way that would create this new state-of-the-art sewage treatment plant. And then this, which people see, and they know that part. The part that people don't know is that tunnel, this 10-mile tunnel that starts at Deer Island and goes out into the deep Atlantic waters of Massachusetts Bay. It's an engineering marvel. There's not a single pump or electrical source inside it, and it moves up to 1 billion gallons of wastewater every day.
Right. So essentially, as you write, every flush in eastern Massachusetts first goes into the Deer Island treatment plant, and then through that 10-mile-long tunnel, as it's, you know, it is now cleaner water, effluent, out 10 miles into the bay.
Exactly.
And it's that tunnel that's really at the center of this story. So explain to us then, in 1999, the mission that these five men had and what even put them inside a tunnel that was hundreds of feet below the water.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And one of the themes of the book, I think, is how very smart people can make very bad decisions that put guys in hard hats in harm's way. And that's what happened here, because these were the best and the brightest in the room, the brilliant designers from the world's top firms who created this engineering marvel. But they baked into this project an enormous problem that everyone overlooked until the end, which was there was a series of safety plugs at the end of the tunnel where this horizontal tunnel connects with these 55 vertical risers. And those plugs were in there to protect the workers when they were building the tunnel for almost a decade.
So that water wouldn't rush in.
So water wouldn't rush in if something happened. And there were already safety measures in place, but this was an extra one just in case the first lines of defense failed.
Right.
But no one figured out how those were going to be removed, which is a key issue. But they had so many other problems to work on that kind of fell to the wayside until the end.
So let's be clear here. There's this complicated, huge, multi-billion-dollar engineering design that's going on, whose final completion rests on these plugs being removed, but they went forward with the project without being sure how they were going to get those plugs out.
Yes, and that gets into the organizational behavior and dysfunction that happens in complicated projects where the various sides are so worried about offloading risk onto other parties and protecting themselves that they sort of just kick that can down the road until it's too late.
Which is something we've seen in a lot of very big engineering projects in Boston, even not not just worldwide, but here especially. But let's talk about exactly what happened to these five men. They were commercial divers, and you just described sort of their journey down into the tunnel with such detail. So just tell us the story. Take us into those first moments where they started going foot after foot down into the Deer Island tunnel.
Sure. And the key thing to remember here is all the life support in the tunnel, the systems that were in place that kept alive the tunnel workers for the decade when they were building this tunnel had been ripped out.
That's so air, oxygen, transport,
and lighting, all gone. So as you said, a pitch black, oxygen-starved tunnel, almost 10 miles long. It's 24 feet at the beginning. At the end, it chokes down to 5 feet in diameter, and these pipes that the plugs are in that the divers have to crawl into are 30 inches wide, scarcely wider than the divers' shoulders.
Okay, so I want listeners to just imagine for a moment what you just said. You're in a space, you're hundreds of feet below the water of Boston Harbor and the seabed, right? It's pitch black, a kind of blackness that maybe none of us or few of us have ever experienced. And you're in the narrowest portions of the tunnel, which are barely wider than your shoulders.
Exactly. And you have to maneuver yourself in such a way that you don't dislodge your breathing equipment, because one or two breaths of this tunnel air, the ambient air, will be fatal. That's the conditions that these guys were sent under. They were essentially sent to the moon. It's just the lunar landscape they had to contend with was the one inside the Earth rather than orbiting around it.
Yeah.
But they were that cut off from civilization.
So what air were they breathing then?
Well, this is the key thing here. Normally, in a job like this, the commercial divers, they were chosen because they know how to do tough jobs in areas where they can bring in their own air. But they'd normally be bringing in high-pressure air, so bottled air that's been tested and is safe. It was too far out to bring in enough of that. They'd have to get all the way out there and turn around and come back because they'd use up most of their supply.
I mean, it took them several hours even just to get to the end
just
of the tunnel.
Just to get there, yeah. So the parties brought in an outside engineer who came up with this plan, which was to use liquid oxygen and liquid nitrogen, because you can carry a lot more of those, and vaporize those right there in the tunnel so that the divers would be breathing off the vapors of this liquid supply. First of its kind, never been done before, so the normal instincts that the divers had weren't there, because they were told this equipment is different and novel and everything will be fine.
This is another point that you make in the book, though. I mean, we haven't even talked about what happened to the divers, and we will in a moment, but yet again, we have the words first of its kind, unplanned and untested coming up. I mean, we have the lives of five men at stake, multi-billion dollar project at stake, and yet an investigator later said that their breathing system was like a bad eighth grade science project.
Yeah, the difference between how this was presented versus how it actually showed up was enormous. And that gets to, I think, the larger issues. I think there are very particular details to this story that won't be repeated. But the forces that created the problems here are universal to any ambitious undertaking. And that's why I think there are these large lessons that we can all learn from this story here. Mm. And that is, make sure how something is presented, just because it's the first of its kind, it should pass the common sense test. And that wouldn't have happened here had people looked at this clearly.
Right. So we should honor these men who were down there by telling listeners their names: DJ Gillis, Dave Riggs, Donald Hosford, also called Hoss, Billy Juice, did I say his name right? And Tim Nordine. So they were the five men who went down. What happened to them?
So those divers went into the tunnel, and as I was saying before, the tunnel, because it chokes down in diameter, they took these specially retrofitted Humvees as far as they could drive into the tunnel, and they took two of them, one heading east to the end of the tunnel and one heading west back to Deer Island, because there wouldn't be enough room to even open the doors all the way, never mind turn around. So that gave you a sense, and that would only get you a portion of the way into the tunnel. And then from there, when they got past the 9 mile mark, two of the divers stayed in the Humvee and monitored this experimental breathing system that all five of them were relying on to live, while three of them trudged on foot to the very end of the tunnel carrying a lot of heavy gear with them in these hoses, which divers refer to as umbilicals, because they can't survive without them any more than a baby in the womb can survive without her umbilical.
And so then? I mean, so they've got to shimmy up the vertical shafts to remove the plugs.
So they go as far as they can, and then one diver will have to crawl, as you say, into these connector pipes. Everywhere that this horizontal tunnel connected with these 55 vertical pipes, there was a plug. And that meant a diver had to shimmy into those, remove this 65-pound plug, extricate both the diver himself and the plug out, and then someone else had to go in and videotape it to prove that the plugs were taken out. I mean, this was the enormous sequence of events and skills that were required just to do this.
And something goes wrong right after they remove the first of the 55 plugs.
Yes, the plugs, while they're working on this equipment, the breathing equipment starts to fail, and it's hard to tell exactly what's happening because they're, again, at the edge of civilization here. Two of the divers collapse, and there's a foreman out for the three-man crew that's at the very end of the tunnel, and he has to make a decision about what is going on here, tries to connect back with the guys in the Humvee, calls them in a panicked way of what's happening here, what's going on with the breathing system.
Hmm. Now, I'm wondering if you could, you write about these moments so descriptively. Like, honestly, as I was reading the book, I began to feel somewhat claustrophobic because to imagine what they went through it's just really harrowing. And I wonder if you could actually read just a passage for us from the book. And this is from the section in the story where you talk about, you describe how they're in the tunnel and things are going wrong and the two divers have collapsed because the beginnings of the failure of their breathing equipment.
Absolutely. Haas had never been in such a strange situation in his life. Here he was nearly 10 miles into a dead-end tunnel under the sea, and he'd just seen the two other guys on his crew collapse. And yet, in some ways, he'd never felt so good in his life. What he was seeing was danger and doom in the darkness around him. What he was feeling was freedom and lightness, as if he were being transported to a beautiful place. He had moved past the frustration stage he'd felt 2 days earlier when his face mask had sucked to his face, and he seemed to be moving briskly through fogginess, headed for euphoria. Somewhere at the base of this purple haze, he sensed that he had to fight it.
That's Neil Swidey reading an excerpt from his new book, Trapped Under the Sea, One Engineering Marvel, Five Men, and a Disaster 10 Miles into the Darkness. Neil, just tell us briefly, what was the fate of the five men who went down there?
So five went in, only three made it out alive, and it was only through the heroic acts of those three survivors that they made it out. They came within 30 seconds of all, investigations showed later, of all five of them perishing, and it's just astounding to think what could have happened there if they'd all been lost, and people would have had to make the decision of, do we go back in? How do we go back in? What is going on at the end of this tunnel? So it really was heroic actions on the part of the guys who made it out and sadly on the part of the guys who didn't.
Listeners, as you can hear, I've got a bit of a cold. So if you hear me cough a little, Neil, will please forgive me in advance. I promise not to cough all over you. A bit of a frog in my throat. But Neil, how much... So this is a disaster unfolding underneath the waters and seabed of Boston Harbor, but it obviously didn't start at the moment that those men first went down the tunnel. And that's really, other than the story of who these five men were as human beings, that's the other part of this story. How far upstream, time-wise and organizationally, did the disaster begin to unfold?
Yeah, that to me is really what attracted me to the story and to go deeper into the story, because now I see the lessons of this story and the forces at work in this story in so many different contexts outside of this, both in you know, disasters, the BP oil spill, you can see shades of this, the same forces in place. You can also see things that have nothing to do with disaster, the rollout of Obamacare and the failures there. You can actually look at the organizational behavior forces at work there from this story and see shades of that there. I mean, I think what this shows, at least for me, is you need to be aware of how organizations function and where those sources of failure or possible failure are to avert disaster. There's this idea that disaster doesn't happen because of one big screw-up. Disaster happens with a series of small mistakes that cascade and line up so that the holes in the Swiss cheese line up, and that's when this horrible outcome can happen.
Well, at the same time, though, it's the people who have to take the physical risk who you know, they're closest to the actual disaster unfolding, but those who are deciding ultimately to send men down into a dangerous tunnel are, you know, both sort of metaphorically and physically so far away. I mean, in the case of Deer Island and the cleanup of Boston Harbor, you had federal authorities involved, you had state authorities involved, you had all sorts of construction contractors, both large and small. How does risk and responsibility spread through a system like that?
It's a fascinating question, Meghna. And I think one of the most gratifying things for me in terms of the reaction, early reaction to the book, has been from people who are actually decision-making makers in this story. And what they've told me is, now I get this. Now I was so locked in the battles at the time, trying to beat these other parties who were, had become adversaries at the end of a long, complicated, expensive project, that I lost sight of what we were asking workers to do. I mean, so they've said, we think all young engineers, young public policy people, and old people coming out should have to read this story to understand, for a reminder, that there is a connection between the decisions you make and the workers who have to bear the brunt of that risk to bail you out.
Right. You know, and I think one of the things I found most affecting about the book is you start off in the prologue describing how DJ Gillis, one of the divers who went down into this tunnel, you know, even though he'd been doing this kind of, maybe not this exact type of job, but, you know, commercial diving for years, he had a sense of foreboding about this mission to the point where he wanted to put a little, not trinket's not the right word, but a little
religious medal
in his hard hat of the Virgin Mary, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is, DJ's an incredible guy on this, and a miraculous medal that Catholics entrust with the Virgin Mary on it had actually been his grandfather's. His grandfather was a carpenter who'd helped build the Prudential Tower, and he kept that in his pocket for the entire time he was building the Prudential Tower. So the night before the accident, because there were 2 days of problems on this job where the divers were sent in on day three, the night before, he asked his mother for his grandfather's medal, and he was very hesitant to do that because he knew it would worry his mother. They had this unspoken language. Divers tend not to tell their family and loved ones exactly what's going on in the job. It's not fair to dump that kind of worry on them. But he took the chance here just to feel so I could have that medal. And as soon as he asked his mother, a look of worry played over her face. But he put it in there. He tied it to the underside of his hard hat, and still to this day feels that that's what helped him get out.
You know, in every major high-profile engineering project ever undertaken, there is going to be some risk. Now, granted, over time, through better safety and design, that risk has been, you know, vastly diminished. But people remember, you know, photographs from the 1930s of those guys on the ends of like big I-beams of skyscrapers just sitting there having their lunch. That's sort of a lighthearted notion of it. But there have been, you know, many deaths on every engineering project. I mean, isn't that kind of one of the dirty truths about the steps forward that we take as societies? Like, we would not have Boston Harbor as its shining, clean example today if someone hadn't taken a risk.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, there used to be a kind of chilling expression used in the tunneling industry of a man a mile. You build a 10-mile tunnel, you should expect to lose 10 men. But that was a long time ago. And as you say, we've gotten a much better, and there's been a much greater appreciation for the cost of mistakes and the cost of human life, not just in human terms, but in financial terms, so that projects on the whole are much better off and much better designed to avoid that. But at the end of the day, we have to remember that no matter how grand the designs are on paper or on a computer screen, nothing is built on paper or in pixels. Grand things are built by people. Right. Using real equipment, taking on real danger.
We've just got 15 seconds or so to go, but one of the things I want to tell you is I'm glad, so glad that you brought the story to everyone, because it was literally buried in the newspaper on the days that it happened because someone else had died.
Yes, John F. Kennedy Jr.'s plane went down. It's interesting. People ask me, is this fiction? No, this is complete nonfiction, but people don't remember it because it coincided with one of the biggest stories of the year, if not of the decade there.
But Neil Swiety has actually now brought us the full story of the five men who were trapped under Boston Harbor. The book is Trapped Under the Sea, One Engineering Marvel, Five Men, and a Disaster 10 Miles into Darkness. A phenomenal read. I encourage you to do it. Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. It's been a pleasure.
There's more of the show in just a moment. This is Radio Boston.